Thank you very much for being in our assembly tonight to worship God. What wonderful praises we sing together in contemplation of who our Creator is and the blessings He's provided for us. The spiritual blessings that are in Christ Jesus, Ephesians chapter 1. And how those blessings are uniquely designed for people on earth. How wonderful it is to contemplate such great blessings. And how we are so very thankful and appreciative for our Heavenly Father for suiting those blessings to our needs so perfectly. Thank you for being in our assembly tonight. We're using our Sunday evenings to study the James of the Old Testament, as I like to call it, because the lessons of the book of Proverbs are so very, very practical. And tonight we take our information from Proverbs chapter 8, verses 10 through 21, a short section from chapter 8, where once again Solomon reminds his readers about the value of wisdom, the virtue of wisdom, the victory of wisdom, and the voice of wisdom. A lesson that he has repeated to his hearers many times, and I think from that we can realize the importance of it. As we revel together in the value of wisdom's words, we see wisdom's wealth being compared in verse 10. Receive my instruction, and not silver, and knowledge rather than choice gold. The comparison between those two in verse 10. We also see wisdom's wealth described as something beyond compare in verse 11. For wisdom is better than rubies, and all the things that may be desired are not to be compared to it. Silver and gold and rubies, even in a superabundance, would be nothing but mere things. But you know, things can dominate people's lives. The poor man may spend his life worrying about the things that he does not have. But on the other hand, the rich man may very well spend his life worrying about the things that he does have. Yet Jesus said in Luke 12 and verse 15, that a man's life consists not in the abundance of his possessions. The world of thought is far more important than the world of things. Things are deceptive. They hold our thoughts down so that we become preoccupied with material things that we see and touch and handle and trade and do business with, those physical, temporal, or transient things. And our attitude toward material possessions will determine whether or not they stand between us and God. It all depends on our attitude. I was taught that a gun can either help you or harm you depending upon how you use it. And so it is with material gain. It can be an aid to our lives, an aid to the service of God, an aid to our service as we strive to serve Christ, or it can be a hindrance to our fulfilling our responsibilities to our God. Our earthly goods can just as easily be a distraction of Satan as they can be a blessing from God. And the determining factor will be our attitude toward our earthly possessions. And the materialistic society that we live in pushes us toward a certain conclusion or choice in life, doesn't it? It promotes the idea of gaining as many possessions as we possibly can. And in order for you to be considered a success in life, you must be a person who has quite an abundance of material possessions, quite an accumulation. Many brethren now have the attitude that working to pay for a new home or a new car or a new boat is even as more important than teaching the lost, and even more important than meeting with the saints of God on the first day of the week sometimes. But wisdom in this book would have us look upward. It would have us look to heaven for the conclusions of life and the attitudes of life that we should develop in our own character to bless our lives before God. The desire for wealth will fasten our gaze upon this world. But wisdom would teach us to gaze at the world to come and lay up, as it were, treasures in heaven and become rich toward God. Luke 12 and verse 21. Wisdom is better than wealth. Wealth can be lost, but wisdom partakes of the infinite nature of God, and wisdom endures forever. These are the things that Solomon would have his readers to contemplate as they see a comparison made between wisdom and material things. In verses 12 and 13, when he talks about the virtue of wisdom, so that we can benefit from the virtue of wisdom, Solomon would have us note where wisdom dwells. I, wisdom, dwell with prudence, in verse 12. Wisdom and prudence are like twin sisters. You know, we have talked about wisdom being presented in this book as a beautiful woman, a desirous woman, figuratively speaking. And the prudence would be a twin sister of wisdom. The word translated prudence means discretion, good sense, the ability to make responsible decisions, those good things that we like to see in our children as we raise them and they begin to make responsible decisions of life. And don't we just become joyous and smile on the inside, if not on the outside, when we see our children make a good, wise decision about something? It does the heart good, doesn't it? That when we see discretion in them and good sense, because sometimes in our children and growing up and allowing them to make their own mistakes, we see some choices they make that are not really what we would call good sense. A person can have wisdom without having good sense. But good sense brings wisdom down to earth, so to speak. It makes it practical. It relates it to everyday life concerns. A person can have a lot of wisdom in some areas, but lack common sense in other areas. Solomon, for instance, had a great deal of wisdom, didn't he? He's famous for his wisdom in resolving conflict between the two harlots that were fighting over the same baby, each claiming that the child was her own, you remember? There was no identification mark on the infant, no way for anyone to be able to discern, any other person to be able to discern, no way for the child, the infant, to be able to discern which was his mother. There were no witnesses to give evidence. How could anyone then discover whose baby this really was? The women were equally determined in their efforts to lay hold to the claim that this is my baby. The problem seemed to defy solution, so Solomon did a wise thing when he called for a soldier and a sword, didn't he? Defied the living child in two, the king said. Give half to one and half to the other. Then Solomon keenly watched the faces and the reaction of these two women. Horrified, the real mother cried out to let the other woman have the child. Pointing to the woman who protested the slaying, the king said, give the living child, she is the mother thereof. Solomon's reputation as a wise judge was thus established, and fear of him because of his great wisdom, fell over his entire kingdom in 1 Kings chapter 3, 16 through 28. Solomon had great wisdom when he had to resolve such conflicts. He had a remarkable insight into psychology, what we would call psychology today, political science, natural history, but he had no common sense, no prudence when it came to the question of who am I going to marry? A very, very important question of life faced him. Who am I going to marry? What abysmal folly it was for him to marry an Egyptian woman and to make her his queen. How foolish he was to marry an Ammonite woman. To trust the future of God's people to a son who was half pagan. What utter lack of common sense that really was, and was demonstrated by marrying 1,000 women. It was foolish, terribly foolish. By the time Solomon was ready to write the book of Proverbs, he had doubtless seen how imprudent he had been. But by then, of course, it was too late. And the very best that he could do then was to advise people to prize wisdom and prudence as twin sisters. Solomon advised us, furthermore, in verse 12, to know what wisdom does. I, wisdom, find out knowledge of witty inventions, if you're using the King James Version in verse 12. This fragment of Scripture has been translated in various ways here. I possess knowledge and discretion is the New International Version's rendering of that. I find out knowledge and discretion is the American Standard Version. I know where to discover knowledge and discernment is the New Living Translation. And the Young's Literal Translation, a knowledge of devices I find out. And obviously there's no consensus of exactly how this verse should be translated into English by those who are in that business. The Septuagint reading is, I call upon understanding, that is, it is I who inspire all good and righteous thought. The Hebrew word translated witty, about witty inventions in the King James Version, means sagacious. And sagacious is a word that just means keen in perception. You likely went to a high school who had a certain couple who were voted on by the senior class as being most witty. Okay? So you know what the word witty means there. The most keen in perception. Wisdom gives men flashes of insight into the true nature of people and things. Some people have that. I don't necessarily regard myself as one of those. A flash of insight led to the invention of the alphabet, for example. It was witty to do that. It was a keen sense of perception for someone to come up with an alphabet and writing. And the same flash of insight would lead to the mechanical kindling of fire. That same flash of insight might lead to the invention of the wheel. Every inventor has a dash of this kind of genius about him, we call it sometimes, I think. Consider the inventive genius of the human mind through the centuries with me just briefly, as I jotted down some things that might seem to fit here in the contemplation of witty inventions. 4,000 years before Christ was born, the Egyptians were said to have learned how to mine and smelt copper. About 3,500 years before Christ was born, the potter's wheel as far as we know from archaeology, developed in Mesopotamia, as did wheeled vehicles. In about 2,900 years before the Lord was born, the Egyptians built the Great Pyramid of Giza. The Romans developed concrete about 200 years before Christ was born. The Chinese invented paper about 140 years before Christ. And then after Christ was born, about 600 years afterwards, windmills appeared in Persia. And about 1,040 years after that, the Chinese invented gunpowder. In 1070, they began to use the magnetic compass. In 1288, they invented a small cannon to be able to use that gunpowder. And 1450, eyeglasses were invented. The first adding machine was invented in 1642 by Pascal. The first barometer was made in 1643. 1698, the first practical steam engine appeared. 1709, Daniel Fahrenheit developed the first accurate thermometer. The first hot air balloon was launched in 1783. The cotton gin was invented in 1793. In 1800, a man by the name of Volta invented the first battery. 1804, canning food was introduced. 1837, Samuel Morse patented the telegraph. 1839, Charles Goodyear discovered the process for vulcanizing rubber. A sewing machine was invented in 1851 by who? Singer? Isaac Singer. The first oil well was drilled in 1859. In 1865, Joseph Lister discovered the use of antiseptics. There's a product on the shelf at the store now called Listerine. In 1876, Alexander Graham Bell invented the telephone. 1877, the internal combustion engine was invented. 1879, Edison discovered how to make electric lights. The phonograph was invented in 1888. 1903, the Wright brothers flew the first airplane. Plastics were introduced in 1909. 1924, the first television was made. 1928, penicillin. 1929, Goddard introduced the first instrumented liquid fuel rocket, the first electron microscope, 1931, nylon, 1934, radar, 1937, 1942, Enrico Fermi built the first nuclear reactor, transistor was invented in 1948, 1957, the basic idea for the laser was developed. Now, these are just a few of the many inventions that came from the ingenuity of men, and all of these things affect our lives and touch our lives in some important way. And this is the kind of spark that Solomon is talking about when he is talking about something having to do with knowledge of witty inventions. I, wisdom, find out knowledge of witty inventions. Find out about knowledge and discretion. This unique perception into people and things. Where does that come from? You see, would be a question that a lot of times our sons and our daughters of young age ask us. And that list, little list that I threw together is not by any means complete. But these things were the work of very diligent work and perception, insight, genius, we might call it. Every now and then, someone got this flash of insight and displayed a certain amount of extraordinary wisdom in an invention that used creative ideas. The creative ability that God put in men is real and it's alive and it's active. This creative ability. And men began to have this unique perspective into the way that things work according to the laws that God has put into place and established as far back as creation. Next, Solomon pointed out what wisdom detests in verse 13. The fear of the Lord is to hate evil, pride and arrogancy, and the evil way, and the froward mouth do I hate. God draws this line through human activity, through the human race, and through all of history. And on one side of that line, we find things like evil and pride and arrogance and evil ways and evil words. And then on the other side of that line, Solomon says, that's where wisdom is. And there's this deep chasm here on this line that clearly separates the two sides. Wisdom deliberately and categorically disassociates itself from all of the things on the other side of the line. And people who practice them are not wise. They have no part of wisdom. The line is too distinct and too separating. People on that side of the line, Solomon says, are fools. To depart from evil, Job 28:28, is really a far cry from hating evil. A person can depart from evil and still yearn after it in his heart, if you think about it. Hatred of evil can come only from a grasping and clinging to the divine wisdom that comes from God. In contrast, human wisdom urges men to be open and tolerant of evil and rationalization. Humanistic psychology, largely a vast excuse-making apparatus in motion, attempts to come to terms with irregularities in human behavior. Human laws based on human wisdom address always, it seems, the symptoms of some kind of evil rather than the cause. Usually, these laws never address the real, true cause for evil among men, do they? The cause lies much deeper than the legislative, executive, and judiciary branches of the government, and much deeper than these branches of government would dare probe. Many of our laws are the result of compromise, if you think about it. And all too often, lawmakers actually end up legalizing such evils as prostitution and gambling and sodomy, even. Some legislators would even like to legalize the use of mind-altering drugs. There's been a movement in this country for a long time to do that. Because of the flaws in our legal system, few drug czars, mafia dons, or international terrorists really ever see the inside of a prison, do they? Even when laws are just and impartially applied, they really don't get to the heart of human misbehavior and sin. Human laws do not deal with the lust behind the actual committing of adultery, or the hate behind the actual committing of murder. Judges do not sentence people for their evil desires. But the Lord was very clear in describing for us the place where the root of sin lies. In Mark 7, beginning in verse 20, the Lord said, "That which proceeds out of man, that defiles the man. From within, out of the heart of men, evil thoughts proceed. Fornications, thefts, murders, adulteries, covetousness, wickedness, deceit, lasciviousness, an evil eye, railing, pride, foolishness. All these evil things proceed from within and defile the man. We do what we do because we are what we are. What is truly in our hearts really finds its way out, doesn't it? Sooner or later, it does, because that's who we are. What we do is what we are. Only divine wisdom deals with what we are inside. And really it all begins when we learn to hate the things that God hates and to love the things that God loves. That is true wisdom. When we learn to hate sin. In the next section, we see the victory of wisdom once again. Solomon saw all-conquering divine wisdom reigning and noted its sagacity, its strength, and its supremacy. In the first part of verse 14, he speaks of wisdom's sagacity. Counsel is mine and sound wisdom. The second part of verse 14 speaks of its strength. I am understanding. I have strength. And then in 15 and 16 speaks of the supremacy of wisdom. By me, kings reign and princes decree justice. By me, princes rule and nobles, even all the judges of the earth. Solomon reviewed the entire judiciary here, didn't he? From the Supreme Court, as of course represented by the king, to the district courts represented by the princes and the nobles, down to the local courts represented by reference to the judges. If there's one thing a man must have if he is to occupy a position of authority over other men, he must have wisdom. A wise ruler will reign in the affections of his people, but a man who makes foolish decisions and unfair or unfounded sentences will soon earn the people's hatred. We see that in biblical history, don't we? David's sense of honesty and fair play made him what type of king? Was David hated or was David loved? He was loved, wasn't he? No doubt Solomon had often observed his father on the throne. Solomon had seen David weigh issues and carefully think about them before giving a conclusion. Solomon had heard David ask very penetrating questions to find out information to help him to judge adequately, rightly, and fairly. Solomon had observed that David consulted with his counselors and even referred to the book of the law to make decisions. Solomon had noticed the upward glancing of the eye, possibly, when David was perplexed about something and thought of God's law and God's way and felt a special need of the wisdom that came from above. Solomon had often marveled at his father's impartiality, his passion for truth, his passion for justice, even. Justice often tempered with mercy was shown by David. No wonder David was called in the scriptures a man after God's own heart in 1 Samuel 13 and verse 14. And of course Solomon knew of the classic occasion recorded in 2 Samuel when a young Amalekite came to David in order to report the death of King Saul. The Amalekite told how Saul had attempted suicide and had asked him to finish him off. And he said this, "So I stood upon him and slew him because I was sure that he could not live after that he was fallen. And I took the crown that was upon his head and the bracelet that was upon his arm and have brought them hither unto my Lord." The young man doubtless thought he was bringing this great good news to David. probably expected a great reward. And he must have been quite astonished and also alarmed at David's reaction to what he said, for David didn't rejoice over that news at all, did he? Saul, on some 24 occasions, had tried to murder David. But when Saul died, David rent his clothes, which was a gesture of the most penetrating grief. And he commanded a period of mourning and fasting in memory of Saul and his son Jonathan. When David turned on the Amalekite, David's questions were direct and to the point. "Whence art thou?" he demanded. And he said, "I am an Amalekite." David read a world of significance in that answer, if you think about it. Think about it in connection with 1 Samuel 15. The Amalekites that God commanded to be destroyed, that weren't by Saul. And so, if you were in the room, you could imagine seeing David's face turn to this growing distaste. And David asked this man, "How wast thou not afraid to destroy the Lord's anointed?" David asked at last. On at least two occasions, David could have done what the Amalekite had done and rid himself of his enemy. But that was not David's way. He always left Saul for God to deal with. What tremendous wisdom that truly was, when you think about it. And far from rewarding the young man for slaying Saul and bringing the news of Saul's death and the insignia of royalty, David was really appalled at the situation. The man was not only a man of homicide, he was also a man of regicide, killing royalty, murdering royalty. There could be only one punishment for that crime, and it was death. "Thy blood be upon thy head," David said after he passed sentence, "for thy mouth hath testified against thee, saying, I have slain the Lord's anointed." That was really the kind of justice that men respected. Is it any wonder to us that the subjects of David loved him tremendously? Every man there that day knew that if David had found King Saul in his death agonies, he would have cherished him. He would have bound up the king's wounds as the Good Samaritan bound up wounds on another occasion. David would have poured oil and wine in those wounds. He would have tenderly carried Saul to a place where he could be receive the best of care, be comforted, and be rejuvenated and restored to good health. David would have prayed for Saul's recovery. That is why the people loved David so tremendously. He was not only just, he was also a good man. Then in beginning of verse 17, we see the voice of wisdom further. "Having seen wisdom reigning, Solomon heard wisdom's voice saying, I love them that love me, and those that seek me early shall find me." In verse 17, Solomon was telling us whom wisdom loves. Love is reciprocal. It is a two-way street. And those of us who really seek after wisdom will find that wisdom is seeking after us. We do not have to wait until we are old to seek wisdom. The older we get, the more set in our ways we become, generally speaking. The sooner we start looking for wisdom, the better. Joseph, Samuel, David, Solomon, Josiah, and Daniel all sought wisdom early in life. And we're blessed by that seeking. Consider Samuel. Even before he was born, he was the subject of persistent prayer on the part of his mother. When he was born, Hannah called his name Samuel, saying, "Because I have asked him of the Lord," in 1 Samuel 1 and verse 20. And when Hannah brought Samuel to Eli, she said, "For this child I prayed," 1 and verse 27. "For this child she never ceased to pray." Never ceased to pray. Hannah gave her little boy back to God just as soon as he was about the age where he could dress himself, comb his own hair, and run around the house. When she handed him over to Eli, she redoubled her prayers for her son. And little Samuel sought the Lord early on in his life. He loved the Lord, and the Lord loved him. And little Samuel found the Lord, or rather the Lord found him. Samuel responded very early to this spiritual education that the old priest gave him. Soon he knew as much about spiritual things as Eli knew. About the burnt offering, about the meal offering, about the peace offering, the sin and the trespass offerings, the table and the showbread, the golden lamp stands, the golden altar and the veil in the temple. Soon he knew very much more than Eli. And wearing this little coat that his mother made for him, Samuel became a feature and an attraction of the tabernacle of God. As his young heart opened like a flower to divine truth, and as his godly mother prayed to water the seed as it was sown, Little Samuel heard something that Eli never did hear, or at least, to give him the benefit of the doubt, no longer heard. Samuel heard God call him and speak to him by name. That's incredible. Like his illustrious Lord, when he was manifest in the flesh, Samuel grew in favor with God and man, and God was with him. And soon all Israel knew that God, who had been silent for so long, was talking again. The dark days of the judges were about to end, and a new day was dawning in the history of God's people. People called Samuel the seer, because he was able to see into the hearts of men and also into the very heart of God. Solomon also heard wisdom's voice say in 18 and 19, "Riches and honor are with me, yea, durable riches and righteousness. My fruit is better than gold, yea, than fine gold, and my revenue than choice silver." Solomon here was telling us what wisdom lavishes. The riches offered by wisdom are durable. You know, other riches, the riches of men, have a bad habit of disappearing, don't they? But wisdom, once acquired, cannot be squandered. Solomon heard the voice of wisdom saying, "I lead in the way of righteousness in the midst of the paths of judgment, that I may cause those that love me to inherit substance, and I will fill their treasures." Verse 20 and 21. Solomon is here telling us where wisdom leads. There is a right way and a wrong way to obtain riches, if riches we must have. Riches that are not acquired in the way of righteousness will never bring us the true happiness that God desires men to have. God really wants us to be happy. He truly does. In conclusion, wisdom's path never leads to regrets. Never. When we choose the path of wisdom, we choose the path of God. We choose the path of right. We choose what's honorable and fair. We choose what will truly bless us in this life. We choose something that will not destroy us and bring us down. Something that will not eat away at our soul and destroy our lives. We choose something wholesome and good and rich and wonderful. And it can not only bless our lives, but it will bless the lives of the people around us too. If you're in our assembly tonight and you're not a Christian, we ask you to think very seriously about your soul. And if we can assist you in your obedience to the gospel of Christ, we'd be most happy to do so. If we can, please come to the front and let us know how we may help you while we stand together and encourage you by the singing of this song.